Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Jose Mercado, national security and foreign policy expert with 30 years of U.S. government service. Jose most recently served as deputy director for Western Hemisphere Affairs in the State Department's Human Rights Bureau. He's a U.S. Air Force veteran and diplomatic security special agent, and he specializes in democracy, human rights, and crisis response, all useful skills and experiences. So, Jose, welcome to the show. I'm so glad we're both armed with our coffee in our favorite mugs. Can you tell me about your fancy mug?
So, yes, I can. Well, first of all, thank you for having me.
Of course.
It is a privilege for me to do with this this interview with you today. So throughout our career, and I say our because I include my wife in this lifestyle and career.
Snaps for that. Hold on. Snaps for that. This is a family commitment. We don't talk about that enough, but go on.
So I'm not a Starbucks fan.
Okay.
And I don't know if I can say that.
They're not sponsoring the show, so it's okay.
Hey, Starbucks. Sponsor Kate.
Okay.
But I like their city mugs. And wherever we go, especially if we're spending a considerable amount of time in that location, we'll get the mug because they do say something. At least they get that right. So we went to visit my dear friends and my godchild's parents in South Africa. And long story short, we get the mug. That's the one thing I wanted. Yeah. We're flying back through Cameroon to get back to Equatorial Guinea. And then they wanted to take the mug away because it was considered a weapon. It's a mug. Like, this is ridiculous. It's a mug. No, yeah. It's a weapon, but I had to use every single ounce of diplomatic skills to get my mug back. So I love my South Africa mug. I think I might have hidden behind other people and just finally grabbed the mug and kept going. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So listen, aside from sneaking mugs through security, where did you grow up? Who raised you? And how did you kind of find your way along this path into public service? Because it really is a calling, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Wow. That question is, it's a long one.
Yeah.
So I was raised by my mom and dad, who have both passed away now. I was adopted the day I was born. I came home 3 days later. I actually had to ask one of my aunts and my cousins because I thought I came home the same day, but they clarified, no, it was 3 days after. I was like, okay, so I didn't come home like right away.
Yeah.
But my parents were both public servants. They worked for the power company in Puerto Rico. I grew up in Puerto Rico. I went to school in Puerto Rico. So many of my family members are or have been public servant. So that's part of my learned DNA, if you can call it something. And I always had an interest in serving in some capacity. But yeah, my parents raised me, super loving environment. My family, which is ginormous, especially on my dad's side. My mom, my dad had 18 living siblings, including him. And my dad's story is fascinating too. And well, more than mine. And my mom, they're six total, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
So huge family who received me with open arms and in that village helped raise this Tasmanian devil hurricane that is me. So yeah.
Yeah, so a big, beautiful Puerto Rican family raised you and modeled hard work and service and giving back. So then what led you to decide to join the Air Force?
So that's a funny story. A friend of mine wanted to join the Army ROTC and asked me for a ride. It's like, okay, I'll take you there and I'll just chill here while I wait. So I was waiting and I was looking at the posters, looking at the pictures in the detachment and in the building. And this guy comes and starts talking me up. And it's like talking to me about the Air Force and this and that. And I'm like, hey, I'm just here waiting for someone. But in the conversation ends up being that he knew my dad and I used to deliver his newspapers at one point in time. In some way, he convinced me to take the Air Force officer's qualifying test. And it was more of a challenge than anything.
Mm.
So I took it, I passed. And that's how I went through ROTC in Puerto Rico. When I had not received my
Yeah.
commission, then when that came to the mainland.
That's wild. Isn't it amazing how sometimes these life-altering moments just kind of happen, and in the moment you might not even realize it's happening, but then you look back and you're like, that was huge. That was pivotal.
Yeah, especially because I never, so I knew I was going to serve in some capacity. I saw myself serving local government in some way, but I wanted to be in private industry.
Okay.
I loved my school, La Universidad del Sagrado Corazón, and I studied marketing. And I saw my future in the marketing field. And I was a pretty good student at that. So I never thought that this wasn't a plan. Like, you have a lot of people that have always wanted to be something.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I want to be a pilot. I want to be a doctor. I want to be, you know, a mechanic or an electrician. No, that wasn't like in my cards.
I feel like actually I've been surprised to learn through these conversations and these episodes I'm recording that I would say more than half of the people that I've talked to had a similar experience to you where they weren't actually targeting the career that they ended up with. And I think it's a really good example or a demonstration of the fact that like life's a journey. You don't know where you're headed, and that people of all backgrounds and all experiences can be really valuable contributors to the American project.
We are definitely a project.
Yeah, we are a project. We're a project. So listen, you were in the Air Force, but when you were in the Air Force, did you decide when you joined, were you thinking I'm going to like do a whole career here with the Air Force? Or did you think this is going to be a season, but I still have these other interests I want to pursue?
So when I started, we have a commitment. It was 4 years at the time. I was like, okay, I'll do the 4 years and then I'll see. After a year and change, I was like, okay, this is going to be a career.
And 4 years because that was how you would get college paid for. Is that right?
So for yes, but I wasn't a scholarship cadet.
Okay.
So I didn't have that. But once you accept the commission as an officer, yeah, it was 4 years. I don't know if now it's 5 or 6, or but yeah, that back then it was 4 years. So after a year and change, I was like, okay, this is my life. This is what I want to do. This is where I want to be. I was pretty happy. The only issue I had is that I'm not one to stay behind a desk, hands on. In the trenches kind of an individual. And I didn't want to use the word leader, but that's where I like to be. And the career field where I was put, which is a funny one, wasn't like that.
What was it? What was the career
field? So I was a finance officer.
Okay.
Yeah, I was a finance officer at the first couple of years, the first 3 years, then I did information warfare the following two, and that led me to a job at the U.S. Embassy in Muscat.
Okay. So this is a good segue then. How did you get to the State Department? You set it up for me. That was perfect.
See, I did it on purpose. So I started to get enamored with foreign affairs. Actually, not true, because when my first semester in college, I studied in St. Joe's University in Philly, and I was studying international relations. Then I was recalled by my parents back to Puerto Rico. But that's a different story. We're not talking about that one today. So that was already something that I was interested in. But once I had the chance to work at an embassy, I was like, this is something that really interests me. I took the foreign service test, officer's test. I missed the orals by this much. It was less than a point.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So anywho, I was like, okay, I'll take it again. I'll do this and that. And then the ARSO at the time there, I knew that I was looking for a change, and him and the RSO, we sat down one day, we started talking, and
and for
my
people
attention.
Who don't know, RSO is the regional
Sorry.
Security officer.
Correct.
Right?
So we are special agents. So we're fully fledged federal law enforcement officers.
Mm-hmm.
Even within the department, a lot of folks, especially in the Foreign Service, they refer to us as RSOs all the time. There's usually one RSO who is the lead federal law enforcement officer in a country,
Right.
depending on the size of the mission. And
Yep.
everybody else is either a deputy or an ARSO, an assistant regional security officer. But yeah, between the assistant regional security officer and the regional security officer, at the time we had a very good conversation, and they opened my eyes to something I didn't even know about. And I was like, okay. So I took the exam, passed, and I set that aside because I was getting assigned to Germany. And I was starting to think about where my Air Force career was taking me. And many, many months later, I get this email asking if I was still interested and wanted to go to the oral examinations. It was fortuitous that I was going TDY to Mississippi for some training. And I was like, okay, I can go one Friday and take a test. And I took it, I passed. And then here I am today.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, what was your experience like, and how did you then transition to working on some of the other issues that you covered while you were at the State Department?
So I was always interested in the bigger, broader mission. When diplomatic security special agents are in the States, we tend to focus on two things, either criminal investigations or the protection side of the house. So protecting the Secretary of State, deputy, and visiting dignitaries below the head of state. So that those are the two fields. So there are other types of things, cybersecurity and other type of work that we do. But that's the main focus. Overseas, while our job is to provide a safe and secure place for Foreign Service officers to work, we also have to understand the macro level political environment and foreign policy environment so they can actually do their job, right? So we get intimately involved at times with what's happening, not only in the mission, but also in the country and the bilateral relationship. And that definitely interested me. So in the different missions and different jobs that I took, I got more interested on that side. While I was in Equatorial Guinea, I had the opportunity to serve as the acting deputy chief of mission on numerous occasions. And that opened even
That's a big
more.
deal. That's a big deal for people who aren't familiar with like the hierarchy of embassies. That's super cool.
So I had the opportunity to not only work with my colleagues, but also lead them with my civil security background and military background, and specifically where we were assigned to. Then the pandemic hit, and our mission was, it was to start, it was a small mission, and it became even smaller. So the few of us that remained behind at POS, we started taking more responsibilities in. And by the end of my assignment, not the end, by middle or a little bit more than middle of the assignment, I was kind of burnt out. And I told my ambassador at the time, amazing individual, that I wanted to take a pseudo sabbatical, and I wanted to go back to school. And she fully supported it, and I applied and was selected for War College at the Inter-American Defense College. And it's something that I had wanted to do when I was in the military. It was like, okay, when I am this rank, I would love to go to the Inter-American Defense College, because I wanted to work in this region. Obviously for personal reasons and personal interests, but also because I like the overall mission in the Western Hemisphere. So I went there for a year, almost a year, and then I was like, okay, where am I going next? I didn't want to go overseas because my wife wanted to become a civil servant. And my career was already starting to, that plane was starting to land. And hers was going to take off. And I was like, okay, it's her time now. I want something here domestically. But I didn't want to go back to DS, to diplomatic security. I wanted to do something different. And I wanted to do something in the Western Hemisphere. I had just spent a year getting educated And becoming friends with 60 leaders in military, diplomatic, and police leaders in the hemisphere. So I was like, I need to take advantage of this. So I applied to different jobs within the department as a political officer. And I was selected to come and work in DRL. That's how I initially landed in DRL.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so then for you and I, like understanding, and for many of the people who are still listening to this show who are other feds, I think listening to each other's paths, and for future or aspiring feds, it's really helpful to listen to other people's paths just to understand that like, A, there is no one way. It's really like an iterative process building a career. And there are so many different factors that weigh in. I think it's super important to talk about the personal and the family factors that weigh in, because we don't operate in a vacuum. Like if you have family and friends, they're a part of your decision too. Your wife's career was a consideration in your career decisions. And I'm so glad that you voiced that, because that's so real. That's the way that my husband and I have had to navigate our careers, investing more in one at a different time, because you can't necessarily go all in on everything at the same time. So I'm glad you mentioned that. And now I'm going to pivot to the section that I told you I wanted to call the diplomat versus the bureaucrat. Okay, because we talked about this earlier. Do you think that movies and TV shows and other like pop culture items about diplomacy and intelligence are doing us any favors in terms of letting the American public know what these jobs are all about or not?
That's a loaded question.
What do you mean, Jose? All of my questions are perfectly crafted and totally benign.
So the issue is, and I've voiced this in many different venues, the department has a communications problem. Mm-hmm. And because we work in foreign policy, people see it as foreign, something that is not directly related to them. Mm-hmm. And whenever you see diplomats or anybody working overseas with the Department of State, all you see are either these luxurious parties, cocktails, complex plots that make no sense, or you go on the extremes of the Jack Ryans of the world, or the totally unrealistic, but some people find it fun, the diplomat on Netflix. Mm-hmm.
I watched it with my husband, but paused every 30 seconds to critique, which I'm sure he found super annoying.
My wife found it annoying.
But I'm like, that would never happen. She doesn't even have talking points or background.
My wife was like, listen, just relax and watch the show. Like, it's a show. Yeah. They are bound to make mistakes, but it's a lot of them, they're bound to make them. It's like, just enjoy it. And, you know, once I started enjoying it, I was like, okay. But yeah, it's a cognitive dissonance between what we do for the American people and what they think we do. And that's where I believe the communication problem lies, is we haven't been able to translate exactly what we bring to the table and the importance of our work. Especially when you hear in the news, you hear it more and more, soft power versus, you know, the hard power. And for people that don't know those concepts, it's typically or traditionally you hear hard power as military. Mm-hmm. And then soft power, you have diplomacy, economic policy, mm-hmm. Those type of things that help bring people to the table to speak and negotiate. Even within the department, you have, and for those folks in your audience that don't know how a department is built, you have the secretary, deputy, mm-hmm. then several undersecretaries and undersecretariats, and then within that you have bureaus and offices. And where I used to work in DRL, it was a bureau, and it's a functional bureau. Mm-hmm. So we had a very specific set of skill sets and issue sets that we worked on, mm-hmm. for which we served as a check and balance to,
in concert with all of the regional bureaus, like figuring out how to apply those
correct.
Concerns and those priorities within the regional context.
Correct. Which when you're talking about the regional bureau, you're talking about a broader issue set. So a more holistic approach to working our foreign policy, whereas for us, Ndiarle was more guided towards good governance and protection of human rights and the labor, because we dealt with international labor affairs.
Yeah, and I feel like it's maybe helpful at this point to nerd out for a second on like why that division exists, like why we need regional bureaus and functional bureaus, or why that was set up that way. Because really, like, to get the best policies on any given issue in a given context, you have to look at it from multiple angles. So the functional bureaus have the role of being experts in their function and then looking maybe across a region or even across the globe at how that issue manifests or what best practices are, like, for promoting democracy and protecting human rights. But then the regional bureaus, they're like, we're the experts in our region. Country desk officers are experts in their country, and they can work together to say, like, this is our priority, this is our priority. How do we find the best way to meet everyone's needs and come up with the best possible policy that, like, checks all those boxes? Would you say that's fair?
Very fair. And I was just, while you were talking, I was also thinking about how can I explain this in a way that somebody could understand it fairly quickly. And I started to think, when I was a very young man, many, many moons ago, and I wanted a car. And my parents were like, well, you get to use our vehicles. But then thinking as a young man, well, you know, if I want a car, I want something fast and shiny. But as a parent, you're like, there is no way you can have an inexperienced driver get into a Corvette or a Porsche or whatever, because you don't have the skill sets to drive that vehicle in a way that is going to be, or the finances that is going to be safe. So I don't want to sound patronizing,
right,
but that knowledge of those particular areas in which, let's say, the US government wants to do business in country X, fantastic. But there are issues within country X that we know that we need to help them move through those issues before we can say, hey, this is a place where we can do business freely and openly. And we're not trying to be a wall. It's more of a speed bump.
Yeah.
So we can slow down and think. And I mentioned this earlier, we brought those checks and balances to the table that, when not done separately with enough authority, usually get set aside.
Yeah. Yeah. What was your first car? What was the first thing you drove?
The first thing I drove was a Buick Skyhawk. It was white and red on the inside. It was my mom's car.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah.
My first car, like the first car I bought for myself with money that I saved up from my job when I was like 17, was a 1995 Jeep Grand Cherokee Laredo.
Nice.
I was obsessed with Jeeps. I got this thing for like $3,000. It had like, it was so loud. It had like no turning radius at all. But my parents were happy with my choice because it was like a tank, like indestructible. And I, to this day, am obsessed with Jeeps, but they're not always the best investment. But anyway, they're also not sponsoring this show, so that's okay.
The first car I drove, I bought, was a Volvo 240 from 1988, and this was in 1996. So that's the first thing I bought with my own money.
My first car was also like 11 or 12 years old, so it was like not top of the line, but totally great for a beginner. Okay, so shifting a little bit, over the course of your career, you know, you've had lots of twists and turns. I'm sure you've discovered things about yourself. What have you been surprised to learn about yourself?
Oi, so that is, that's a very interesting question, which I really have to think about. Mm. You're asking that question, and the thing that popped into my mind was something my dad told me before I left Puerto Rico to come to the continental U.S. or the mainland, was that folks tend to judge cultures or where people come from based on the individuals that they meet along the way. And that I was not only representing myself, but I was representing him, and I was representing other Puerto Ricans.
Well, no pressure.
I was like,
they're
yo,
like,
man,
don't F it up.
Yeah, I was like, come on, dude. Like, really? I don't need this right now. So I think that the one thing that comes into mind about what I've learned about myself is my capability to learn new skill sets because of the love that I have for service.
Yeah.
And how I want to improve things, especially leave things better than I found them.
Where do you think that comes from?
It comes from my dad.
It's from the values that your parents instilled in you, just that it's your responsibility to give back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's my dad, after he retired, he opened a very small contracting company, very small. He worked mostly in our neighborhood. And that was very meticulous.
Mm-hmm.
And one time he lent a tool to one of his friends. And when his friend brought it back, my dad was like, "Do you see this?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's, you know, whatever tool mm-hmm. it was." I don't remember what it was. It was like immaculately clean. And this is how we should be, you know. Take pride in your work, but also in things that are not yours.
Yeah.
While what we do is technically ours, it is not. And as a public servant, most public servants come to work for the U.S. government because they have a love for their country and people and service. We don't come here to become rich. We don't come here because this is the most exciting or the most innovative thing in the world. But you come because you have a desire to better our country. And I definitely learned that is my shining star, my guiding star, is leaving things better than I found them.
Yeah.
And that is my strength, is openness to learn and then work towards improving that what was given to you to work with.
Yeah. So with all the pressure that your dad placed on you through his words, but also through his example, and like the fact that you really wanted to live up to that. And I think, you know, a lot of, especially fathers and sons, I have three boys. Like, I see the way that my boys look up to my husband and the way they want to be as great as he is at everything that he does, right? Do you think that ever gave you like a certain imposter syndrome or struggles with like really living up to what you held for yourself as a standard?
Oh, I've always had imposter syndrome. I suffer through it till this day.
Yeah, same.
I have never felt that I belonged.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that I was not, I don't want to say the smartest person at the table, but that I was not as smart or as capable as the people surrounding me. That's why I always looked to surround myself with incredibly sharp, smart, talented individuals wherever I worked. But, and when I tell people that, they're like, "What are you talking about?"
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you've been highly successful. Like, we look up to you. And I'm like, "What?" I just can't, for some reason, can't see it. It's extremely hard.
But I think a lot of times when we hear about imposter syndrome and we think and talk about it, we try to correct it or like remove it from each other as if it's an entirely bad thing. And I really feel like there are two sides to this. Like, unchecked, yeah, it's a problem, because then it means you've got all these gifts and talents and things that you don't feel confident enough to contribute, right? But a healthy dose of humility or like the ability to see yourself as flawed is super healthy, I think, and can be a part of like keeping you curious and willing to learn from others.
Indeed. The last thing you want to be is an insufferable know-it-all.
Right. And like, you know how they say, like, bravery requires fear. Like, you're not being brave if you're doing something you're not afraid of. You're actually being brave if you conquer a fear. So if you experience imposter syndrome, like I did an event yesterday where I was like, "Am I the best person to speak on this issue?" But I was like, "Well, I'm here now, so I'm going to just do it, do my best." And they called me for a reason, and I trust that. Then I, you know, delivered on the event. And after, I felt like maybe I am in the right place at the right time. And you just kind of have to trust and push yourself through things that make you uncomfortable to level up.
Yeah, this is like going back to that point we talked about a little bit earlier about mm-hmm. that openness, it is what you're saying, it holds water. It's like you have to be open enough to know what your flaws are, but also what your talents and your skills are, and recognize you're good at something. Mm-hmm. Everybody's good at something. Exploit it.
Yeah.
And maybe exploiting that will lead you to other places that you didn't think you could be successful or good at.
Right. Like, you would not have predicted when you were a kid that you would have had the whole journey that you did and done everything that you did.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay. So, final question, my favorite question. And if you thought the last one was complex, buckle up.
Bring it.
What does it mean to you to be an American? What does it require of us today?
Oof. Wow. Okay. Dead air.
Dead air, so our listeners can also be like, oh my God, I don't know.
Well, that question does require you to take a step back and really think, because being American is so many things, but you're part of a collective of individuals that built this nation on hard work, but also a set of freedoms that we definitely take for granted. And especially, I don't want to get political, but our nation is fragile. Our democracy is extremely young. And most folks think we've been here forever, and that things that are the way they are now have always been that way.
Which is a privilege that was paid for.
And they have not. Like, okay, when were women allowed to vote? Mm-hmm. Allowed.
Yeah, not very long ago.
So it's one of those things that, and watching in the news, there are folks that are advocating for the repeal of that article of the Constitution, or the amendment of the Constitution, 19th Amendment. So we have to protect our democracy and our values and those things that we hold dear. Being an American requires a level of compromise, but also of sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And it's not that, well, everybody's going to join the military and go defend our nation. You can defend your nation right from your home. You can defend your nation by going to vote in every election possible, from candidates to school board to your local well, here I'm in Virginia, so here is the House of Delegates, and then the Senate, the state Senate, and governor, because local laws and local elections are extremely important. So it's that type of thing, being involved in civic duty, is part of what makes us an amazing place to live in. And you have, as an American, you have a duty to maintain or help keep your nation as strong as it is, or even stronger, with that level of openness that we talked about before, in which everybody can participate, everybody has rights, and you and I defend theirs and they defend ours. And that is what, you know what, being an American is being a damn good neighbor. And loving one another and helping one another. I think that's what it is.
That's beautiful. And I think part of the reason why I decided to interview public servants for this project, aside from the fact that, like, this is the community that I was privileged to be a part of, is also because public servants are the ones who have made their participation in the American project very explicit through their careers. But as you're saying, we are all a part of the project. And if we want to see ourselves reflected in it, we have to use our voices through all the you know, channels that are available to us, like voting. I love the being a good neighbor thing. I just want to, like, mic drop on that Mr. Rogers moment.
Hold on, let me go get my sweater.
All right, well, listen, Jose, thank you so much for being here with me today, for having such a thoughtful conversation, for being generous with your reflections and experiences and sharing your beautiful family history with me. And finally, thank you for your service to our country.
No, definitely, Kate, it's been an honor and a pleasure, not only to serve our country, but to be here with you. And if I can do one plug on your show,
please.
I have a cadre of individuals that unfortunately, were there was a reduction in force in the department and they lost their jobs. These are dedicated, highly educated, motivated, and professional individuals that would serve anywhere at the highest level and are ready to start working. So if any of your listeners and any of you, the people that watch want that type of individual to work for them or with them, call me.
Yeah, 100%. I'm glad that you added that. I had the privilege of working with many of them and I will second everything you just said. All right, Jose, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Kate. Take care.